Well, good evening and welcome, folks. It's nice to see you all here. This is the second in our series of three talks. It's the title More Than Conquering. Last evening we looked at More Than Conquering Your Suffering. Next month we're looking at More Than Conquering Your Circumstances, slightly different slant on it. Tonight we're looking at the past. Next week we're sort of looking at the next month we're looking at the present. We're holding these because we believe that the Bible is the answer, the only real answer to life's problems. And you know, whenever we talk about the Bible, we're talking about not religion. Biblical Christianity is vastly different to religion. Religion is a set of rules that keep people chasing a moving target, because you're always trying to see, have I done enough now to please God? Is that enough yet? Is that enough yet? And Christianity, biblical Christianity, as the Bible describes it, is a relationship that sets people free and gives them a purpose in life that far outlasts anything else. And we're thinking this evening about our past and the purpose that Christianity gives and the freedom it gives outlasts anything else, and that includes our past. This evening I want to show you that the help that is offered to those, there is help offered in the Bible to those who are struggling with a past that haunts them or simply just won't let go of them. And if that's your case this evening, there's hope. There's hope. And hope's what is needed, as we've seen all too tragically this week here in Letterkenny, where we saw a young woman taking her own life and the life of her child. Hope, it would seem, for her had run out. And as we come to consider our past, who we are is in part the result of the decisions and the influences of other people around us growing up. Our character isn't formed in a vacuum. We live in a broken world where there are many who have been shaped, there are many who have been shaped by circumstances and situations of their growing up, and that impacts their here and now. And the scars of those circumstances can lie across our souls. And we only get one life. It doesn't seem fair that the actions of others in time past, or our own actions at a time when we were perhaps less mature, that those actions should have an impact now and mar and ruin who we are. It's possible to live with the past and yet not cope with the past, and it can gnaw away at us in different ways. And we can become trapped, and we can think that we have to remain victims. But as we said on the flyer, the past might define us, but it doesn't have to defeat us. And how is that the case? Well, this evening I want to tell you a story from the Bible, one of many that shows the transforming power of Jesus. And by way of a roadmap to where we're going this evening, well, you can see it on the handout, but there's four areas that we're looking at. We're going to look at the defacing of a life. Then we're going to look at the reclaiming of that life. And then the recommissioning of that life, and at how this reclaiming and recommissioning can happen. So that's where we're going. I want to look first of all at the defacing of a life. And I want to introduce you to a man. We meet him in Mark's account of the life of Jesus. He's in chapter 5. And as we come to think about this man, perhaps you're here this evening and you're hurting in your past, or you're hurting in the present. Listen as I describe this man and see if there's things you can identify with. Or perhaps you're here and you know people who are hurting and you want to be equipped to help them. Listen for points that you can identify with for them, so that you can take this to them and say, look at what Jesus did for him. He can do the same for you. This man that we meet in Mark chapter 5, he has a family, but his family want nothing to do with him. They've put him out. He's a man who's alone, who's an outcast. The people of the town that he lives in don't want anything to do with him either. It's not just that his family have put him out and he's got a lot of friends elsewhere. The people of the town want nothing to do with him. His problem isn't so much a sickness or an illness. And part of the way his problem shows itself is, here's a man who hates himself to the point of self-harm, lifting stones and gouging his flesh, and leaving deep gashes on his body. He's a man who feels like nothing and has been made to feel like nothing. He's got made to feel that he's got nothing to offer. At night, you know how the night makes it hard. The long, dark night, this man finds himself sobbing great, wailing howls of anguish. And yet, dawn doesn't bring any peace either. We read that his same howls escape from his lips during the day. And as time goes on, things don't get any easier for this man. You know why sometimes people say, time heals? Not for this man. Not for this man. It just seems to get worse and worse. There was a time when he could manage and he could control things a little bit, and people could control things a little bit for him. But now it's got harder. People have tried in their own way to help him, but it's of no use. Something or someone has walked across the surface of this man's life and left great dirty footprints across it. Here's a hurting man. Let me read to you just what Mark says in Mark chapter 5. They went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons in his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Day and night, among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. That's the opening section. And by choosing this passage, I'm not for a moment saying that if you've a hurting past, that you're demon-possessed. No, no. But I've chosen this passage because it teaches us several important truths. And one of those is that evil, wrong, the things that have happened to us, or perhaps the things that we have done ourselves, can't be understood simply in human terms. Because if we're going to find a solution to our hurting past, we need to rightly understand the problem. And the great tendency in our world, particularly in the West, is to see things in simply human terms. And let's explain our problems, and we try to explain them with psychology. Well, what happened to you in the past? Maybe your father left, or your mother mistreated you, or you didn't receive proper attention, and that has had a negative effect on your life. Others say, no, it's not just people's upbringing, it's the whole of society. If we had right education or right government policies, things would be okay. Others say, no, the problem's not mental or in society, it's chemical. And if we have the right tablets to take, everything will be okay. And we see this tendency to blame problems on genetic defects. Now, there's an element of truth in all those. Medicines can be of great help in treating different illnesses. Therapy and counselling is helpful. And problems can be helped by right policy decisions and education. But yet, we know, don't we, that there's more to the hurt in our lives than just these things. Take it for a moment on a much bigger scale. Look at Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 1940s. Are we saying simply that these people weren't educated enough? Are we saying simply that these people hadn't been loved enough by their parents? Or that they had chemical imbalances in their brain? No, there was something much deeper, much more wicked and much more evil driving this. And the poet W.H. Auden, he lived in New York for a time in the late 1930s, 1940s, and he lived actually in the German sector of New York. And he went one night to see the screening of what was actually a German propaganda film. And he saw the people that he lived amongst, nice, ordinary, decent people living in New York. Whenever the Polish people came up on the screen in this in the newsreel, or the German propaganda newsreel, they rose and they shook their fists at the screen and said, "Kill them! Kill them!" And Auden was horrified. Here was a man who was actually an atheist. And what this did was this shook his faith in atheism. Because he had always thought, well, there's no God, so there's no devil. But he saw in this something much deeper, something much darker. He saw in these people that they had been sucked into an evil system that far outweighed, that wasn't accounted for, because the sum of all the people there, they were good people. They were good. They were morally decent and upright. And yet, he could see something running through this. And he said it shook him, it shook his faith in the atheism, because he couldn't account for it. He couldn't account for the presence of such an evil. And you see, there is more to evil than simply the human. One writer, a scholar from Columbia University, argues that we need to remember this and get back to this idea of there being a devil and there being a force outside of us that is evil. That's simply what the Bible teaches. Simply what the Bible teaches. Demons are real, the devil is real, and there is a being who seeks to deface and vandalize and ruin the lives of people. When we read about demon possession in the Bible, we've got to remember that the Bible isn't full of primitive people who were stupid and who attributed all sorts of illnesses to demons. No, no. In Matthew chapter 4 and verse 24, we read that they brought to Jesus all who were ill with various diseases, those suffering severe pain, the demon-possessed, those having seizures, the paralyzed, and he healed them. What's interesting to note about that is, do you see the different categories they have? They've got the diseased, they've got the paralyzed, they've got those suffering various illnesses and severe pains, and they've got the demon-possessed. And the phrase that's translated in the New International Version, those having seizures, is actually much broader than that. It refers to all those with problems of the mind, from ranging from irrational behaviour right through to insanity. And it puts those in a completely different category from demon possession. So we can't say these people were primitive. They understood something that was lost in later times, in the medieval times, when people blamed the spirits for all sorts of things. Demons are real. The devil is real. And in this passage, we have a snapshot of what the devil likes to do to people. Look at this man that we have here. Picture him in your mind's eye. See how he's been dehumanized. There he is, out living in a cemetery. Out living in a cemetery. Now, tombs in those days weren't quite, it was not like our graveyards. Big rocks with caves cut into them, with shells where the bones of the dead people were laid, and he's in amongst those, and that's where he's living. Not all of them had boulders rolled across the front, as we're familiar with from the story of the resurrection. That wasn't always the case. This man's living in a graveyard. His hair will be long and matted, his beard matted and long, and his body covered in cuts, bits of chains hanging off him. He's naked, he's got no self-respect left. And he's running around howling and leaping and scowling at people. And he's a man whose life has been vandalized. Vandalized. Here's a man who was made in the image of God. Made to know God and to enjoy God. And his life has been vandalized by some forces outside of his control. And he's been making misery, the devil, of people's lives. Not just this man, but people's lives throughout history. He's been ruining the one life they get. Life's meant to be a beautiful tapestry, and this vandal comes along and slashes it and seeks to destroy it. But unless we realise that, we're not going to be equipped to deal with the depths of the hurt that he has caused. We can treat the surface wounds, but there's a pus that lies deeper. Now, maybe you don't live naked in a cemetery yourself, and cutting yourself, but I wonder, can you identify with some of the problems that this man faces? Perhaps like him, it was something outside of your control that's come into your life and caused immense hurt. Maybe you've been left feeling isolated from family and friends. Perhaps a bereavement of someone close to you has meant that ties have been cut with family members, and they've moved on a bit and you're still sitting hurt. Or perhaps you feel isolated in this because of decisions you took in your past decisions that you know were wrong. But you've been left where you were, and people have moved on, and you've been left behind, physically separated from those closest to you. Or perhaps you've been isolated because something has happened and family or friends want little to do with you. Here's a man who's isolated. And there's a haunting phrase that occurs twice in verses 3 and 4. No one could help him. No one could bind him. Just no one. No one. There's no one there for him. He's alone. He's alone. It's possible to be alone, isn't it, in a crowded place. We know that feeling. Amongst people, and yet feeling very much separate from them. Here's a man who's alone. He feels like nothing. And he's treated like a nothing. Have you ever felt like that? Satan knows that humans are made to know God. And that gives us a great value. We are made. We're the only part of creation that is made in the image of God. And that was so that we could relate to God and enjoy him. And Satan wants to make us feel like nothing. And he's got this man feeling like nothing. Is that how you feel? He's dehumanized him. He's defaced his humanity. You ever been made to feel like that? You don't feel like a person anymore. You feel like an object or a case study. And people talk about you as if you're a problem to be solved. That's what they did with this man. People aren't problems to be solved. They're people. They're made to know God, to be known by others. You see how the devil defaces a life. Here's a man who hates himself to the point of self-harm. Many find themselves there. Here's a man for whom the nights are long. The ghosts, perhaps of his past, gather round. Maybe do the ghosts of your past gather round at night when you're lying there and you can't sleep. And the decisions you've made and the things you've said and done stand round the bed and you're reminded of them. They accuse you of the times you've failed. Here's a man who finds the days long. Here's a man who finds his condition worsening. It used to be they could bind him with chains, but no, not anymore. He's got too strong for that. You find that that's how hurt in your life goes. It gets worse. It doesn't ease. People have tried to help him. Have you found that? People have tried to help you, and you've tried different means of seeking help, and you find some respite, but no more. Some turn to medication to dim the pain. Others turn to alcohol to dim the pain. And whenever they find that these options don't work, some decide to end it all. See, hurt is an enslaving thing. And the forces of evil, the devil and the demons, want to get their claws into us and into people. So it begins to control our thinking, to control how we view ourselves, and it begins to define us, doesn't it? People start to see themselves and to describe themselves in terms of their hurt. I'm divorced. I'm from a dysfunctional family. I was abused. And we're not minimizing any of those statements. And sometimes it's the most helpful thing to admit and to make those statements, but to stay there so they control and define who you are is a harmful thing. It has become an enslaving and a controlling thing. I wonder if you find that. Has that been your experience? Where do your thoughts keep turning to? Is it to the past? To the hurts? Then they've become an enslaving thing. One of the reasons I picked this passage to speak on is that here is someone that most of us would have written off. We would have said, oh, you're mad, not a hope, not a hope for him. But with Jesus, there's always hope. So wherever you're at, in your past or in your hurt, it'll be different to his, but the solution's still the same. Or perhaps you're thinking of people that you know that are struggling with a hurting past or a hurting present. And you're wondering, how can you help them? The solution is still the same. We want to look now at the reclaiming of a life. We've seen how a life is defaced. We've seen the importance of recognizing that there are forces at work in this world beyond those that we can see. I want to look now at the reclaiming of a life. Let me read you the next part of the story. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Swear to God that you won't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you evil spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion, for we are many." He begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, "Send us among the pigs. Allow us to go into them." He gave them permission, and the evil spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. Those tending the pigs ran off and reported this in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed and in his right mind. Here's the reclaiming of a life. I know you're all thinking about the pigs. We'll come back to the pigs in a minute. See, and I, well, aren't we? We're thinking about the pigs. That's not fair. It's not fair. What about the pigs? You ever seen a master illusionist? And how he causes you to focus your attention on something over here while something important is happening here. Don't think about the pigs. You see, that's the distraction. That's the causing us to focus on something else and missing the main point. We'll come back to them because they're important. Here we have the beautiful reclaiming of a life. Let your mind's eye paint the picture for you. Paint the picture of the man beforehand amongst the tombs, these rocky outcrops with the caves in them. And you hear this piercing shriek and howl emanating from somewhere. And then you see this being, and there's hair everywhere, and there's blood running from his eyes. There's scabs, there's pus, there's saliva matting his beard, and he's a terrifying sight. Now, in your mind's eye, paint the other picture just beside that one, so you can see both of them. And there's this man, sitting, at the feet of Jesus, clothed, and in his right mind. There's something beautiful about the scene. There's a peace and a calm about it. There's a normality about it. No longer is he naked. No longer is he out of his mind. No longer is he running around like a madman. No longer is he alone. No longer is he friendless. No longer is he distraught. No longer is he bent on self-destruction. No longer is he facing a hopeless, empty future. His life has been reclaimed. It has been unvandalized. It has been restored. You know, it puts me in mind of the line in Psalm 23. "He restores my soul. He restores my soul." And that's what Jesus does. He restores the vandalized soul. He takes a life that's been defaced by evil's attacks and by sin's decisions, maybe things done to us or decisions that we've taken that have been wrong, that have left their scars across our lives. And Jesus restores. He restores. And that's tremendous, because that means that there is hope. And that means that things can be changed. And one of the things that we learn here is that hurt can't be dealt with at a purely human level with human resources. We need more than that. And yet the wonderful thing is, what is impossible for man is possible with God. And I love how this plays out here. Jesus gets out of the boat. This guy comes for help. His problems are many. There's a legion of demons inside him. Now, a legion had 6,000 highly trained troops. So whenever this demon says, "We are legion, for we are many," this is serious. This is serious. And how does Jesus triumph? All he does is speak. It's not a wrestling match. There's not a tussle. There's not a verbal argument or debate. He simply says, "Get out. Get out," he says. There's no battle, just a single command, and the man is set free. And what happens here is stunning. in all the ancient literature where there's talk about demon possession, all the different cultures have their ideas about how you get rid of demons. But the one common thread that runs through them all is this: you've got to call on a higher power. You've got to call on some other god. I remember somebody that used to work with my father had a death threat put on him from somebody in one of the loyalist paramilitaries. And the way he got it removed was to go to his uncle, who was higher up the chain of command. And he went to the higher power, and that dealt with the problem at the lower level. And that's how, in a sense, the ancient cultures thought of how you get rid of demons. You went to a stronger god, and you invoked their authority. And you would say, by the name of Baal, we command you to leave. Notice what Jesus does. He doesn't invoke any higher authority. He simply says, get out. Go. The reason he can do that is that he is the highest power. He is the ultimate authority. See how important that is. We've thought briefly on how cunning and cruel and vindictive and destructive Satan is, and how he seeks to deface and devalue. But there's an answer. And his name is Jesus. And he is the one who reclaims lives. You know, I love this description just of the man seated, clothed, and in his right mind. Again, it puts me in mind of another of my favourite passages of Scripture. Jeremiah 29:11. It's on your sheets there. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you a hope and a future. The Hebrew word for prosper is a word that some of you may know. It's the word shalom. It's the Hebrew word for peace. And it doesn't just mean an absence of conflict or an absence of trouble. It's a deep-rooted wholeness. Everything's in its rightful place in your life. Nothing's out of place or out of sync or out of kilter. Everything's just right. Things are going well. Blessings are overflowing. It's a rich and vibrant word. It's a word of healing. It brings an end to the inner turmoil because everything's in its right place. It brings an end to the conflicts and to the hurting past, to the pain of memories and to the power of memories. And God speaks this promise to his people who are in the thick of a crisis, and he reminds them that he has plans, and those plans are to shalom them, to make them whole again. And that's what he offers. That's what God offers. He offers to put everything to right for you. Find this man in his right mind. Isn't that what we need to be? Because from the times when our past seeks to govern our lives, our thinking isn't right. We're not thinking straight. We're letting the past shape the present. We're focusing on what can't be changed instead of what can be changed. But that is not easy to do. It is not easy to shift our focus from the past to the present or the future, because we've lived with the events of the past so long that they've become part of us. And we see that here in the passage, don't we? Here's this man who's been possessed by demons, and yet he's caring about it. Oh, don't send them out. Don't send them away. Heal me. On the one hand, he wants change. On the other hand, he's formed an attachment. And we can do that. There's an attachment formed to whatever hurts us. They have this description in hostage situations where the hostage actually becomes friendly the kidnappee becomes friendly with the kidnapper or the hostage taker. It's called the Stockholm Syndrome. And that's almost what happens here and happens in our lives. We become friendly with those who have sought harm, and we almost can't live without them or without our past because it becomes such a part of our lives. It's hard to break. It's not that we enjoy the hurt, but it's been such a part of us. We're so familiar with it that we don't want to part with it. And the longer it stays, the more of a mess it makes, and the more enslaving and controlling it becomes. And what this shows us is that it takes the power of Jesus to rebalance our lives and to reclaim them from the past and to set us free. We shouldn't dismiss or mistake the sheer destructiveness of the evil that's around us. We shouldn't want to hang on to the past or to our old way of life. You see the destructiveness here, and here's the pigs. Here's why Jesus permits the demons to go into the pigs, so that they can all see, and so that we can see, the awesome, destructive, sheer vindictiveness of evil. 2,000 pigs, down a slope, over the edge of a cliff, into the sea, drowned. Sheer destructive vindictiveness of evil. And that's what Satan would love to see happen to your life and to mine. Ruined. Defaced. Need to remember that. The verse in Jeremiah continues, not only has God got plans to shalom, to prosper us and not to harm us, but plans to give us hope. And the hope that Jesus gives isn't a vague hope, it's a certain hope. It's something that can't be snatched away. It's so different from the advice of friends. Well-meant advice, but often unhelpful advice when they say things to us like, well, time will heal. Or say something like, well, you just have to pick yourself up and move on. No. The hope that Jesus gives is real. It's real because he's bought and paid for it himself. It's real because it's his to give. And Mark's gospel, these opening chapters about Jesus demonstrating that he has the authority to give hope, and he is the one who does transform situations and gives real hope. Now, the past will always be there. It'll always seek to strip us naked, expose us, and make us feel inadequate. It will. Jesus offers to reclaim your life, my life, to set us free, to clothe us, to give us dignity, to bring us healing, to bring us a peace and a calmness. He offers peace of mind so that our mind no longer races at night. He offers peace. He offers to lift us out of the pain and the hurt. The ancient songwriter in Psalm 147 says, he heals the brokenhearted. He makes the wounded live. Perhaps you're here this evening and you're a Christian. You've put your hope in Jesus. But yet your past still rules your life. Can I ask you gently, who should rule your life? Who should? Isn't it Jesus? And yet because our past is so familiar to us, it's like a comfort blanket. We tend to hang on to it. And we need to seek forgiveness from Jesus for that. He says, look, build your life around me. If we build our lives around anything other than Jesus, we're going to struggle. If we build our identity or get our identity from anything other than Jesus, we will struggle. But when we build our lives around Jesus and his opinion of us, and we accept what Jesus tells the believer, the child of God, the son, the daughter of God, what's true about them. And he tells you what he has done for you. And he says that you're not a second class citizen. You've been adopted and brought into the family of God. And whenever he tells you that you've been invited to sit at the king's table, not for a minute, an hour, a day, a week or a year, but for all eternity, you've got to let that. You've got to let the privileges shape your opinion of yourself and not your past. You've got to let what Jesus has done for you shape your opinion of yourself. Jesus offers a reclaimed life and more. Let's move on. The closing 2 points. We see a recommissioned life. A recommissioned life. Jesus isn't done yet. Isn't that great? He's not finished yet. There's more to do. You know, that verse in Jeremiah finishes off, plans to give you hope and a future. And that's what we see Jesus doing here. Let me read to you just the closing verses of the passage. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Jesus did not let him, but said, go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how much he has had mercy on you. So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And all the people were amazed. A strange thing to our ears, isn't it? Jesus saying, no, you can't come. Why not? Because Jesus had a task for him. He had a job for this man. Isn't that what we need in life? We need a purpose. We need a purpose. Something to do. And Jesus gives this man something to do. He gives him a future. His past has been redeemed. The word redeemed just simply means bought back. It's not as if, well, the past is the past, and that was something that happened to me, and it's done and dusted, and no more can be said about it. Jesus says, oh, no. Watch what I can do with your past. And he takes this man's past, and he makes it useful in the present and in the future, and he sends him off to talk to people about the change that Jesus brings. And the man's story is all the more amazing because of his past. It's a bit like the vandals come along and they look at a canvas and they splash paint over it and it's ruined. Then the master comes along and he looks at it and he takes his brush and he starts to paint and he uses what the vandals have done and he paints away and then you come and look when he's finished and you see how he's incorporated what they had done and he's transformed it into the most stunningly beautiful picture. Jesus sends out this once broken, once hurting, once lonely man so that people can see the change and they're amazed. They see the scars. The scars are still there. The scars are still in our lives this side of heaven. But in Jesus, these scars can be used for good. People will see the evidence of the past. They'll see the transformation in the present and they'll want to know, what did it? Our past isn't consigned to the dump. It's taken and made useful. It becomes the black cloth on which the jewels of God's grace are seen to shine all the more brightly. And against the dark velvet of our hurt and our past, the hope and purpose that Jesus gives shines vividly. In God's hands, our past becomes an asset. It has usefulness and purpose. Joseph in the Old Testament said, my brothers, you meant it to harm me, but God meant it for good. The saving of many lives. Here's Jesus' first missionary, this man, being sent out. Satan had tried to deface his life. Jesus had redeemed it. And now it had a purpose, the saving of many lives. And it doesn't matter how messed up a person can be. Jesus can recommission our past. And you can serve him, not in spite of your past, but with your past. You plunge the hurt and the past into Christ. You can watch him transform it. And I tell you, you'll weep tears of joy to see the years of hurt that you went through weren't wasted, but God using them to bring help and healing to others. And I don't mean help and healing just for a few years in this life, because you can give them good advice. But I mean real help and healing, because if you've turned and found peace through Jesus, you'll be able to point them to a peace and a help and a healing that lasts for eternity. I've seen it in friends of mine. A girl who had a horrific past. Abused. An addict. Different marriages, different children to different men. Horrific past. And yet her slogan is, my past is my greatest asset in God's hands. She's seen God use that to transform her own life and to transform others. How can that be? Just to finish with then. To understand this, we need to turn to the very end of Mark's Gospel. How can somebody be changed like that? And at the very end of Mark's Gospel, we find that this man and Jesus have changed places. Now we find Jesus naked. Now we find Jesus bleeding. Now we find Jesus despised. Now we find Jesus the outcast from the town. Now we find Jesus attacked by legions of demons. Now we find Jesus crying out. Now we find Jesus alone. Now we find Jesus abandoned. Now we find Jesus not just driven among the tombs, but into the tomb on the cross. And Jesus, because he did that, that's how Jesus is able to deal with our past and our hurt and the power that seeks to deface and devalue our lives. On the cross, Jesus takes that power and he faces it and he breaks it. But since the evil just isn't out there, since the problem also lies in our hearts, the stuff that we've done, the decisions we've taken, Jesus on the cross takes that and pays for it too, so that we can be set free, not just from evil, but free from what we deserve. And on the cross, Jesus absorbs sin and pain and suffering and death in himself, so that someday he could do for you what he did for this man here. So that he can offer to reclaim your life. So that he can offer to clothe you. So that he can offer to bring shalom, peace. Peace between you and God. Peace between you and yourself. To restore your soul. To bring peace to a troubled mind. How does that come about? You need to go to Jesus. You need to build your life around him. Say, look, I haven't been building my life around you. Now I want to build my life around you. Need to go to him. Need to ask him to change us from the inside out. Need to ask him to call the shots in our lives so that we will do what he says. The demons no longer call the shots in this man's life. Jesus does. What Jesus says this man does. Will you let Jesus call the shots in your life? The Bible has a word for that. Calls it repentance. Turning our life around and putting Jesus in his rightful place. When we do that, there's a hope, there's a peace, there's a future. When we rely on him for help rather than ourselves, and we can trust him. Because he says, whoever comes to me, I will never drive away. Let me just pray here a moment. Oh, Father in heaven, we do see in this broken, hurting world of ours the dark forces of evil seeking to deface, destroy, mar your creation, and particularly men and women and young people. We see people with little respect for their own life or for the lives of others. We see people losing sight of hope because they have bought into the lie that they are worthless. Oh, Father, how it breaks our hearts to see this. And yet we thank you that in Jesus there is one who comes and who reclaims those who are broken and who are hurting, who restores them, who brings a sense of wholeness and completeness to a broken life, and who goes one step further and who brings that past which has caused hurt to be a thing that will actually cause us joy, because we will see you use it to bring help and healing, eternal healing, to the lives of others. Father, we thank you for what Jesus has done. Father, we pray for those here who may be hurting with their past or their present. Father, I pray for those who don't yet know Jesus as their Savior, that you would show them the infinite value of what Jesus offers to do, so they will find help and healing in Christ. Father, I pray for those who know what Jesus has done, and yet we're so attached to what has happened to us in the past or our shortcomings that we allow them to define us rather than the wonder of what Jesus has done. I pray that you would take the privileges and cause them to outshine the difficulties. Father, I pray for these folks here that you would bless each one of them in the week ahead and show them above all the great worth of Jesus. We ask it in his name. Amen.